What are you most afraid of? Before you listen any further, pause the audiobook, grab your journal, and make a list of things you're afraid of. Anything at all. It is your private journal, so write it all down. Take a look at what you wrote. Keep in mind that the most common fears are death, illness, infirmity, loss, poverty, and loneliness. These are fears that make a lot of sense. They're understandable. But fearing these things can put us at risk when, in our quest to avoid them, we make odd decisions. Once we really give in to the common fears, we often start descending into other, more swampy fears. Fear of not being able to take care of ourselves. Fear of not being loved. Fear of not being good enough. Fear of things not working out. Fear of taking chances. Fear of change. Fear of failure. Fear of success. Fear of growth. And fear of responsibility. So, we construct lives that keep us from having to face these fears. Many of these fears emerge around food. And fears about food, how to eat, what to eat, body image, and weight can lead to lifelong battles with food and eating. Fear is a killer when it comes to favorite foods. We fear being out of control, not having enough, and gaining weight from eating them. Sadly, this can leave us to behave badly in the presence of these foods. The key is to learn to get beyond the fear, to overcome it, and to conquer it. When you have the upper hand at the table, you won't need to rely on stakeholders or prepackaged, robotic, one-size-fits-all meal plans. Why do we panic when a portion is small? I call this the famine mentality. I was raised with this because my parents grew up in India at a time when food was scarce. Although their parents had enough, there was just enough, and all around them the impact of starvation was never far away. Food was sacred. If you believe there might not be enough, you worry. In such a setting, not being able to get food could induce feelings of panic and ultimately some strange relationships with food. Perhaps attachment theory has some applicability to food and why small portion sizes can sometimes throw us when we are trying to manage our weight. People who are securely attached to food may not feel panicky when the food disappears. They may feel comfortable when food is placed in front of them and have an easy-breezy relationship with food. People who are insecurely attached to food may feel scared that there will not be enough and genuinely upset when the food is gone. Therefore, they may feel out of control when food is put in front of them. Most slender people I know who have never struggled with food don't even think about it. They eat, and when they're finished, they stop thinking about it. Most people I know who struggle with food and weight ruminate about food all the time. However, it's not always this linear. I have worked with many people who report that they were raised in homes with healthy rules around food. No clean plate club, no tension at the table, parents who ate in a healthy manner. But in some cases, they married into families with more challenging paradigms about food. I worked with one client in particular who came from a family with very healthy eating patterns, who then married a man whose family was rather skewed about food. His parents were extremely controlling about expecting others to eat on their schedule and would chastise her if she did not order the same quantities as others or finish her food. She also noticed that her husband's pattern of eating involved a very large dinner after a long day of work, and that throughout her life with him, managing her weight remained a struggle. Ironically, the only time she reported being able to keep her weight at the level she wanted was when they had to live apart for a summer. She values her marriage and the relationships around her, so for her, finding a weight management plan that can fit around the demands of her stakeholders has been no easy task. understanding your eating environments and approaches. I still see around me parents who adhere to the call of the Clean Plate Club. My daughter Maya and I were once visiting with friends of the family, and we noticed that all of the children loaded up their own plates and sat down at the table. Maya didn't finish all of the food on her plate, not even close, and when she was done eating, she told me she was full. I told her that was fine, asked her to clear her plate, and sent her on her way. Interestingly, another child at the table observed this interaction. She has a father who was a charter member of the Clean Plate Club, at times tyrannical about the need to consume everything on the plate. She started chiding Maya about finishing all the food on her plate. I warmly looked at the other child and said, "Actually, at our house, we just stop when we are full. Next time, I hope Maya will be more mindful and put a little less on her plate." The other girl dutifully finished everything on her plate. I learned later that she has been struggling with her weight since she was about 9 years old. I grew up in a clean plate family, and I feel strongly about the contribution of early environment or current environment to food consumption patterns and fears about food. It is often easy to see how our current environment contributes to how we eat. Love handles are literally love handles or unloved handles. Nobody can win here. People in relationships eat together. People who are single eat alone or with friends and family. While some people report that once they got into a relationship, they took on their partner's eating habits, usually to bad outcomes, you may also find yourself eating more regularly because of the greater likelihood of sitting down and having meals together. Neither group is free from emotional eating. A single person is just as likely as a partnered person to do so. Your current relationship status will impact your current eating environments. Past environments are trickier. Let me tell you what dinner time in my childhood home was like. It was tension upon tension. Fear of eating inadequately and speaking incorrectly was always present. My parents had a deprivation mentality, in part due to their own histories in India, and wasting was not an option. Even the vocabulary of eating was pathologic. Show your mom you love her and eat that curry. Show me you love me and eat this dessert. Good girls eat all the food on their plate. You are not leaving the table until you finish it. This culminated in all kinds of disordered eating habits, such that when I was full, I would put more in my mouth, ask to be excused, and then spit it out in the bathroom, spit it out in napkins, and so on. At an early age, a feeling of fullness did not imply the end of a meal. The edict of another did. And I would engage in whatever trickery was necessary to get through the meal. Over time, I just ate to please, and I must have pleased the heck out of them, because, as you know, at my heaviest, I tipped the scales at well over 200 pounds. The rhythms of my own house here in Los Angeles, where I reside with my two daughters, are interesting. On a recent Sunday afternoon, I awoke before dawn to work on this book, and then had some fruit at my desk. My older daughter woke up and did her own thing, getting some fruit and yogurt. An hour later, her younger sister awakened and was hungry. I sat with her, had some fruit and tea, while she ate her breakfast, and enjoyed the conversation with her. The older one was hungry about an hour later, and then all three of us joined together. We didn't eat, we just sat with her. We wanted her company, but we did not feel compelled to eat just to be at the table with her. We all ate in an organic rhythm, honoring our bodies, listening to them, but still coming together. What could seem like selfish rhythms from the outside, not honoring mealtimes, actually was an attempt by me to teach my girls on an unstructured day to learn what hungry and full feel like, that even when they are not on the schedule of another, they can honor and enjoy each other's company. Different eating approaches work for different people, and there is no single plan that fits all. Some people don't do well with grazing all day. They tend to overeat each time, make bad choices, and may overconsume. Some people don't do well with scheduled meal times. By and large, many of the current weight loss plans, and even treatment plans for women with binge eating disorder and bulimia nervosa, strongly recommend scheduled meal times that must be honored. The goal of this is to avoid the hungry feeling that can often lead to overeating, to ensure that a person feels sustained and has equal energy throughout the day. I am sometimes leery of plans that require you to eat at certain times because it represents an outsourcing of spider senses. But that is when we need to take a step back. If your spider senses work better with a schedule, that's different. When we break down the science of willpower, this does make sense in some ways. The problem is that many of us do not have the luxury of set schedules. My work doesn't always allow for me to eat a carefully portioned meal at noon. I don't think there is a perfect solution. I think there is only your solution. If you know that grazing is a problem for you, that you have difficulty managing your portions, then your spider senses are telling you that. Honor those feelings and harness regular meal times that work for you. If someone tries to put you on a set mealtime plan that you know would be all but impossible for you, and you are able to tolerate grazing, respond to hunger cues, and honor your spider senses and walk away, then listen to yourself. Some of the first food exercises we will do in the food chapters relate to you learning what full feels like for you by eating slowly. Whatever eating plan you decide on, make sure that it involves honoring yourself and your rhythms. These attachments, fears, and rhythms with food are set early. In many cases, the way we learn to relate to food is also how we learn to relate with our early caregivers. The source of fear. Fear can emanate from many places. True fear and realistic anxiety are useful because they keep us out of trouble. Like knowing to be aware and move to safety on a dark street when we hear footsteps. But beyond that, fear is often learned, and learning takes place in three major ways, the same way we learn how to eat, work, love, and live. It is reinforced. It is paired with something else. We watch other people live in fear. Fear through reinforcement. Reinforcement has a lot of bearing on why we eat the way we do. Reinforcement serves to keep a behavior in place, and it works through reward. Reward a behavior, and it is repeated. If a child does something we like and we give him a gold star, he will repeat the behavior. Fears can be reinforced by parents or teachers who gave us more attention, hugs, or comforting words when we expressed fear. Reinforcement doesn't just relate to fear. Let's start at the beginning. A fundamental and defining reinforcement we received was in the smiles and happies from whomever was feeding us when we were infants. As kids, parents would be happy when we ate our food with gusto. Good work would be rewarded with cookies and sweets, both at home and school. You were such a good girl during your haircut. Here's a lollipop. When your mom wanted to shut you up, in sheer exasperation, she may have given you a cookie. And guess how you reinforce yourself now as an adult? Yes, that same cookie. Fears are reinforced the same way. When we expressed fear, we would get attention, and that would often keep it in place. What about other areas of our lives? When a relationship works and works well, it is inherently reinforcing. You say good things to your partner. He or she says good things to you. And together, growth takes place. There are other reinforcements that keep relationships in place, too, ranging from tax incentives to the support of stakeholders to regular sex, maybe. But the reinforcement of fear is often what keeps relationships in place. The fear of being alone, dying alone, being left to take care of ourselves. And in life, we may work harder if we are rewarded. For example, staying in a job if people praise us for doing so. Sometimes reinforcement can keep something authentic and real in place, and sometimes it may force us to stay in a lie. Universal fears. Albert Ellis, a psychologist and founder of rational emotive therapy, talks about the 12 irrational beliefs that fuel most of our illogical behavior. Many of these underlie the universal fears around the need to always be accepted, always be liked, always be competent, life not turning out the way we want, and the idea that there is a right solution to each problem. These irrational beliefs and the fears that underlie them can often catapult us to struggle with decisions and with simply engaging in the business of living. When fear is paired with something else. Classical conditioning emanated from the work of Ivan Pavlov, experiments that anyone who has ever taken an introductory psychology class remembers. A dog smells meat and salivates. A bell rings every time meat is presented, and over time, when the dog hears the bell, the dog salivates even when there is no meat present. I call it the food poisoning paradigm. If you eat shrimp scampi once and throw up violently afterwards, you are not going to eat it again for a very long time, and the look and smell of it will turn your stomach for months or years to come. Classical conditioning, pairing a neutral stimulus with an unlearned, reflexive one, is a powerful and efficient way to learn fear, and is considered the genesis of most phobias. Theorists like John Watson believe that we could condition a phobia of an innocuous object quite easily, and generalize it to similar objects. We are born relatively fearless of most things, but some things are hardwired. For example, sudden loud noises. So when that sudden loud noise is paired consistently with something that we shouldn't be afraid of, over time we develop a fear of it because of the noise that always accompanied it. Sometimes these lessons are classically conditioned lessons at the childhood dinner table, and eating gets paired with anxiety. This can make food fraught with conflict from an early age. That doesn't mean we can't fight this, largely by unconditioning the original conditioning. But the more intensive the conditioning, the harder it is to break it. Sometimes just the smell of an apple pie can take us back to conflicted family holidays. We just need to re-educate our brains, reconstruct those memories, and make the apple pie in a new setting with a new story. You can learn to recondition the meaning of the dining table, to re-render the meaning of food in your life. The best way to do this is to pair something that makes us anxious, for example, eating with certain people or family members, with relaxation. Take a moment before going into the situation and take some deep breaths. Focus on the relaxed feelings. And even in the midst of what may have been traditionally an anxiety-provoking or just plain scary meal experience, you can start associating the feeling of relaxation with that space. Are there foods that you associate with being out of control, like ice cream? Create a relaxed situation. Work on deep breathing, deeply inhaling, filling in your lungs, and then slowly exhaling. Prepare a small serving of that food, and while you are sitting with it, before you ever eat it, keep breathing slowly and deeply. Breathe in the presence of it. Put it in your mouth and savor it, remaining relaxed and staying focused on the relaxed feeling. You can't just do this once. It's necessary to do it several times, or each time you are in the situation. Over time, you may be able to feel relaxed with those foods, instead of experiencing the automatic feelings of fear and anxiety. Watching other people live in fear. Observing people is an efficient way of learning anything, especially fear. Think of the last time you were in a fearful situation. You likely looked around at how others were reacting, and if they were reacting fearfully, often your reaction would transition over to fear. We learn fearlessness the same way, by watching others. Thus, growing up with fearful parents begets fear. And in the bubble-wrapped culture of modern parenting, fearfulness has become endemic. At the dinner table, a mother with fears of weight gain can communicate her fears of certain foods to a child. Or a parent's fear about not having enough food can stimulate such fears in a child. Much of how we learn to function in our lives, in love, work, food, and play, was learned by watching others. And if we watched fearful models, that fear will carry over into all aspects of our lives. Feared food mistake, avoiding them altogether. When we are afraid of something, we avoid it. That means everything, including food. If we feel like we can't control ourselves with a particular food, and we are trying to lose weight, then that food feels scary, and we avoid it. The problem is, we will be faced with that food again. And then what? How will we react? As a result, many of us live and eat from a place of deprivation. We cut out the scary foods and things altogether. The problem is, this doesn't work. You need to invite the demons to the table and learn to eat with them. Willpower can teach us a lot about fear. We think that by cutting out the scary stuff, we have mastered fear. Nope. Willpower does not generate more willpower. In fact, the opposite is true. Research conducted by Ray Baumeister, a psychology professor at Florida State University, and a scholar who has contributed significantly to our understanding of willpower and decision-making, nicely points out that willpower is a finite resource. Once you start expending it, you start running out of it. So, once you cut out a food group, ultimately you may end up wanting it more and more. Many people talk about how they are afraid of the many choices and foods they are faced with. By understanding how willpower works, you can become stronger instead of panicked in the face of these choices. Roy Baumeister and his team conducted an interesting experiment where they brought research participants into the lab. Before coming in, one group was required to avoid temptations such as candies and sweets. This group had a harder time showing self-discipline or exertion. For example, they gave up more quickly on lab tasks, such as math problems or a test of hand grip strength, a measure of effort on which we tend to expend less energy when our willpower is depleted, when compared to the research participants who were allowed to indulge in the temptation of sweets. We live in a society where self-control is overvalued at some level. We value people who don't eat very much, who are ultra-organized, who don't always show their emotions. The problem is that you have a finite well of self-control to use throughout the day, and the more you rely on it, the less of it you will have. Research by Wilhelm Hoffman, an assistant professor of psychology at the University of Chicago, suggests that we spend a considerable amount of time each day in a state of desire, wanting to eat treats, fool around on the computer, kick it with friends, tell someone off, have sex, or check Facebook. The more you resist these desires, the more vulnerable you become to caving in to the next temptation that comes along. Baumeister and his colleague, Jean Twenge, also did a study on the topic of decision fatigue. Given more options or more to choose from, participants show less self-regulation. This may be why you feel out of control when you go to an all-you-can-eat buffet with lots of choices. But choice is good, right? Not necessarily. If you are buying a house, making decisions about an event, or planning a vacation, after a while you get burned out and capitulate. The overwhelming number of choices leaves you exhausted and incapable of making smart decisions, or any decisions for that matter. There is often a lot of hypothesizing about why our ancestors had better willpower than we do today. They probably did. According to Baumeister, they just didn't have as many choices to make or options to act on. The downside was that they were often restricted in what they could do with their lives. The upside was that they were less likely to succumb to temptations and overdo it. And there were fewer temptations out there. These unlimited choices doom so many of us, not only when it comes to weight, but also other life choices. It's why we carry 50 extra pounds and have 20 pairs of black shoes we don't wear. The fact is, we live in a world full of choices, and choices can be overwhelming, if not downright scary. It's hard to live in this world and limit our options, but we can do it in some settings. Take control whenever you can. Avoid buffets. They may seem like more bang for your buck, but it's just too easy to overdo it. It's easy to get overwhelmed and depleted and start making bad choices. On days when you have to make a big-ticket decision, minimize other choices. Either ask other people to step in, or just make the day less complex by not putting yourself in the line of fire. For example, on such days, avoid shopping, making choices at a restaurant, or making a decision for a group, such as what movie you are going to see. Focus on the big decision that needs to be made that day, and don't clutter the landscape with lots of other choices. If you regularly face many choices in your work or as a parent, purchase the goodies for the bake sale or potluck. Don't go to the mall for the gift. Order a gift card online. Let someone else pick the movie or restaurant. Let's compare these food fears to unrequited love. Think about that person you wanted to be with, but with whom you couldn't or shouldn't have a relationship. You thought about him all the time, and then when you were with him, you felt out of control because you didn't know when you would see him again. Needless to say, the relationship probably didn't go well. That wild, crazy lover is forbidden fruit, and you often ruin yourself in the pursuit of it. Did you see Like Crazy? It was a wonderful movie about the angst of two young lovers who spent years trying to be together, but they were hampered by one's inability to get a visa to move to the United States. In the end, years later, after all the desire and desperation, they finally got together, and the feeling of, what now, overwhelmed the closing scene. My guess? They broke up a few months later. If you want to manage those forbidden and scary foods, here's the best suggestion. Engage in the greatest romance killer of all and marry them. Marry them? Yes. Make a commitment to them, one that you have to adhere to day in and day out, until it gets dull, and you grow to appreciate them, but find that you don't need to gorge on them. Give yourself a daily prescription of the scary food. I had one patient to whom I gave a prescription to eat a 100-calorie candy bar sold by a local grocery store at 3 p.m. each day. According to her, chocolate was her weakness, and she often felt out of control after entirely avoiding it for many weeks. These 100-calorie bars were individually wrapped, tasty, and manageable, and they satisfied her. After a few weeks, The 100-calorie bar lost its luster, and chocolate stopped feeling like such an out-of-control temptation. After about 2 weeks of required chocolate, she reported not caring about whether or not she ate the chocolate, and found that she no longer felt out of control with it. Sexy food and fear. I personally have a list of foods that are my food porn go-tos. They are lasagna, hamburgers, pizza, pasta, grilled cheese, and sandwiches on good bread. I daydream about these foods, and at some level I am afraid of them, because I do feel out of control with their seductive powers. So now I invite them in. Once a week, one of these foods comes in a manageable portion, with a large salad or steamed vegetables on the side. Because I know they are coming, they don't scare me. I look forward to them and welcome them in like an occasional guest. When I attempted to kick them out altogether, things always got a bit out of control. Now, when I'm around lasagna, I'm able to consume it without the crazy passion and fear. Donuts are another big, scary, forbidden porn food for me. Back in the day, when I really struggled with my weight, I ate 2 or 3 a day without thinking about it. The pink and orange letters of Dunkin' Donuts are as classically conditioned for me as any Pavlovian stimulus. When I was in the Atlanta airport recently, the pink sign beckoned. I was hungry, and I went in. I wanted a bite, just a bite. So I had my bite and threw it out. I didn't let fear lead me to binge on it or avoid it. I felt like I showed that donut who was boss. Somehow not buying it felt too deprivational, while eating all of it felt excessive. I was alone, which made it easier, because trying to throw it out under the watchful eyes of another would have left me feeling like I would have to rationalize this bizarre behavior. Why does fear make us eat more often than we should, or not eat? Remember, fear scrambles and all but shuts down our spider senses. It's the equivalent of taking a cell phone into the 6th-floor basement of a parking garage. And as such, our ability to know we are full or hungry gets thrown, and we become vulnerable to signals that have nothing to do with hunger or fullness. Fear can certainly contribute to overeating in a number of ways. We overeat to numb the fear, to avoid the thing we fear, to numb our sense of fullness, and to numb our fears of feeling hungry, empty, letting others down, and breaking childhood rules. Fear can also contribute to undereating, to avoid weight gain, or to exert control in a situation where other modes of communication may feel too frightening. In many eating disorders, fear of gaining weight and fear of being overweight can lead to dangerous behaviors, and it is just as much a denial of spider senses as overeating. Fear and food. Why fear results in overeating. Fear of feeling hungry or empty. Avoid feelings we fear. Fear of letting other people down. To numb fears. Fear of breaking rules. Why fear results in undereating. Fear of being out of control. Fear of being overweight or gaining weight. Safer way to communicate needs or exert control. Fear and scripts. A last word here on where fears hold some of their greatest power, on a future that has not yet been realized. We use scripts to organize our lives, often to disastrous results. Scripts can often force us into the story we expect will happen, rather than the one unfolding in front of us. Given that fear is a powerful editor, it can take our scripts to dark places. If I eat that, I will get fat, and no one will ever love me. I will always be overweight. That man is going to hurt me, so why bother even opening myself up to him? That anticipated ending can lead us to behave accordingly, whether it's eating mindlessly or holding back in a new relationship. People can be loved at any weight. And yes, he may hurt you. But to hold back because of something that might happen is like putting a seatbelt on your soul and spider senses. Let the story unfold. Stop trying to write it, and stop skipping to the last page. Give life, your spider senses, and yourself a chance. Broken hearts heal, but regret never dissipates. The why. Fears can shut us down and lead us to stop listening to ourselves. Fears gum up our works, silence our spider senses, and are usually met with avoidance. People eat to avoid feelings. People have fears about food and eating situations that can make it challenging to eat in those situations. Fears also extend into our relationships. Fear can be like superglue in a relationship. For example, people who are terrified of being alone may cling to a broken relationship with an iron grip for fear it will be their last chance at love ever. Fear can also give our stakeholders even more power, because fear of losing them, or even fear about pleasing them, can lead to some absolute denial of our spider senses in all situations. The best way to choose the wrong door, or never even open the door, is to let fear run the show. When you reflect on any big-ticket decision you have made on the basis of fear and anxiety, you can almost guarantee you made the wrong decision. We give fear its power, and that means we can take it back. Fear drives lots of bad behaviors, largely through avoidance. For most of us, fear is not a comfortable feeling. So, we will do just about anything to avoid it. It is a bit paradoxical. Instead of fear leading us to walk away, sometimes it leads us to sticking around so we don't break any rules. The now. This exercise will require going back to what you did at the beginning of the chapter. Look at those fears you listed. Next to each fear, I want you to indicate what realms of your life it has impacted. Eating, relationships, work, school, parenting. Other habits, such as spending or smoking. Ideally, you will elaborate on this and explain how a given fear influenced something like eating. By understanding why a certain fear affects your behavior, you are better able to pay attention, monitor, and fix it. How can we minimize the influence of fear? First of all, know what your fears are. You already did this by listing them. Second, once you've identified your pressure points of fear and you're facing a big decision, pay careful attention to how that fear could thwart your decision. Monitor and remain aware of what you want, so you can balance that against fear. Third, face your fears. Make a catastrophe list. What would happen if the fears were realized? What if you were abandoned at the altar? What would that mean? Lifelong humiliation? Death? Terminal illness? By taking it to an absurd conclusion and then slowly peddling back, the fears are less likely to own you. You may have lots of fears that have affected you throughout your life, but I want you to isolate those that imprison you and continue to have an impact on your behavior today. Each day this week, or as many days as possible, write down how fears are influencing your behavior. As you think about the now, think about fears this way. What settings bring out fear, and how do they affect your spider senses? Which people bring out fear, and how do they weaken your spider senses? What tasks bring out fear, and how do they damage your spider senses? When you are scared, what behaviors do you turn to? When you are scared, how do you eat? What do you eat when you're afraid? How much do you eat when you're afraid? Reflect on your answers and start thinking about how you can modify those settings, people, and tasks to make them less fearful. Deep breathing, communication, relaxing, self-talk. Look at those eating patterns and think about how you can face those fears differently. See if you find other substitute activities for fear. Make a list of 5 activities that you enjoy that are not eating to use when you are fearful. Chapter 5. Gatekeeping. It is easier to stay out than to get out. Mark Twain. For a person who is struggling with weight management and weight loss, going to a restaurant is like Mortal Kombat. I imagine it like some kind of video game. Breadbasket hurtling at your head. Appetizers being fired at you. Large portions, big plates, and dessert. Eating out often is one of the things that contributes to weight gain. Restaurants tend to use richer ingredients and bigger portions than we do at home. The decisions begin the moment you sit down. Drink? Bread? Butter with that bread? What would you like to start with, appetizer or entree? And then, for the pornographic finish, allow us to leave you a dessert menu to tantalize you, even though you just told us you didn't want any. I remember frequently dining out with an old friend who would be embarrassed by just ordering an appetizer and even apologize for it, despite the fact that in most restaurants, an appetizer is in excess of a normal size meal. Within a 60-minute meal, we are faced with about 10 decisions regarding food and have to make healthy choices in the midst of a minefield. There are yummy smells, bread close enough to grab, and that frequent feeling that you are owed the fettuccine Alfredo because you had a bad day. And, of course, there's the desire to please your waiter. Each choice is a gatekeeping opportunity to not order too much, to order what you want, not what your friends want, to order for the right reasons, to eat a healthy quantity. And you have to do this in a context where you are feeling pressured by your fellow diners. And that's just one meal. If you make good choices from the outset, you don't have to fix a bad decision down the road. That is gatekeeping. Imagine how gatekeeping jumps from the dinner table and into all areas of your life. One of the best uses of our spider senses is to stop ourselves from entering bad situations in the first place. By trusting our spider senses, we become better gatekeepers. Many big-ticket decisions that involve entering into a long-term commitment are influenced by the voices of other people rather than our own instincts. And yet, we are the ones stuck in the situation once we enter it. That's where gatekeeping factors in. It is the most efficient way of using our spider senses because it stops us from entering bad situations at the outset. Getting out is always more difficult than getting in. Prevention is easier than the cure. Gatekeeping is about how much food we put on our plates, because once it's on our plates, we feel compelled to finish it, and the world expects us to finish it. So, whether it's portion control, or walking away from the wrong partner before you say, "I do," or not taking a bad job, you need to use your spider senses to gatekeep the decisions in your life. Whether you are on the cusp of a major decision or need help using spider senses in future decision-making, gatekeeping can protect you and the people around you from wasting time, emotional energy, and resources. Good gatekeeping then becomes a habit that results in keeping the toxic stuff out and allowing growth in. Remember that spider senses are impacted by stakeholders, golden rules, and fears, And because gatekeeping can and should be impacted by spider senses, so too can gatekeeping get thrown by all of these things. Our stakeholders are a powerful influence in the kinds of decisions we make, including what we order and how much food we put on our plates. In a restaurant, even the chef and the waitstaff are stakeholders. They have no idea how hungry you are, but they do know that if they don't give you enough, you may not come back. If you like their food, they feel good about their jobs and perhaps themselves. Golden rules such as happily ever after and the various scripts reinforced by the golden rules can lead us to ignore our spider senses when we are faced with new decisions. And fear may be the biggest gatekeeping killer of all. Our fears of everything, failure, success, letting other people down, or in the case of our plates, feeling out of control with food, can lead us to make suboptimal choices on the way in. The brain-body connection. In 1994, Antonio Damasio wrote the groundbreaking book, Descartes' Error, Emotion, Reason, and the Human Brain, in which he lays out a theory called the somatic marker hypothesis. It is an elegant model that cuts to the quick of understanding how we make decisions, and it has clear implications for gatekeeping. The somatic marker hypothesis says that our bodies, which are a large driving force behind our spider senses, work in cooperation with our thoughts and logic. Very simply, we cannot separate the two, which is in contrast to the idea that brain and body function independently. We are also not computers. We cannot apply steely logic to all that we do, try as we sometimes might. Life does not allow us the luxury of creating a lengthy pros and cons list for every decision we make, because, frankly, it's too time-consuming, and it doesn't always work, especially for emotional decisions like choosing a life partner. The somatic marker hypothesis suggests that our gut instincts make us efficient by knocking out lots of options right away, allowing us to apply some logic to the options that remain when we make a decision. The challenge then becomes the fact that these somatic markers have developed within a context of culture, society, family, and learning. And there's the rub. Not all of these factors, including culture, society, and family, take us where we want to go. And yet, in their fashion, they drive our instincts / somatic markers. A key element of Damasio's work is the issue of learning. Since the day we are born, we learn with a vengeance. The brains of children are electrically wired sponges that absorb everything, good, bad, and indifferent. That learning gets paired with emotions and physiological responses. And over time, we pair those feelings with what seem to be rational decisions. We learn to do this through experience. So when we make certain kinds of decisions, we will have a certain bodily reaction and a certain set of emotions. And over time, the choices and feelings become connected. Here is an example. Perhaps mealtimes for you as a child were a time of anxiety, lots of fighting and conflict. If you didn't eat everything on your plate, you knew anger from your parents would follow, and that would often leave you with a pit in your stomach. So, over time, the dots connected between mealtime choices, feeling anxious, and the racing heart and sweaty palms at those times. So, cleaning your plate became automatic, perhaps a way of avoiding the anxiety that mealtimes bring, and as such, it felt like a choice, even when it wasn't. Whether it's good or bad decisions, the pairing of bodily sensations and feelings can fast-track our decision-making. Our brains and bodies cooperate with the results of that experience, and bodily feelings, brain responses, and decision-making all occur in a beautifully orchestrated dance. Where this can get tricky is that some of this learning, in fact most of it, occurs within a societal context where we are liberally influenced by stakeholders and the world around us. At some level, this is a necessity, since this is how we learn right from wrong, the rules and morals of a society. But it also means that our bodies, emotions, and minds are mired in the lessons of others. And to that degree, at some level, our spider senses do have our stakeholders' fingerprints all over them. Yet, you know that many times in your own life, the thing that is right for you, instinctually, may be at odds with what your stakeholders want for you, even though they were the ones who taught you those lessons in the first place. Gatekeeping and long-term decisions. Gatekeeping is also influenced by the difficult act of balancing both long- and short-term decisions. One of our biggest struggles in making any decision, in essence, in knowing when to quit, walk away, and leave the plate, is balancing the long and the short term. We know how we feel now, but it's harder to determine how we will feel down the road. Psychologist Daniel Gilbert beautifully addresses this tricky balancing act in his analysis of future decision-making. He basically argues that we are not particularly accurate when we attempt to predict our own futures, and the rosy futures we predict for ourselves are biased by our assumptions, attributions, and skewed imagination about what the future may actually hold. People tend to have more difficulty listening to others when it relates to their future. Not long ago, I had lunch with a colleague who recently had a baby. When she was pregnant, I had warned her that returning to the university after her maternity leave would be difficult, based on my own experience. She smiled politely at the time, but after she returned to work, she looked at me wide-eyed and exhausted and said, "This is really hard." I reminded her that I had predicted it would be tough, and she said, "I remember, but I just thought it would be different for me." Gilbert argues that the best source of information about our futures is other people's experiences, especially those currently living the future we want to have for ourselves. For example, if you want to know what your life will look like when you have a 5-year-old child, don't imagine it. Instead, talk to someone who has a 5-year-old, or offer to take care of that child for the day. Thus, when we gatekeep, we are trying to do two things at the same time. We want to balance both short- and long-term outcomes on the basis of experience and instinct. But since we aren't very good at accurately predicting our own futures, and our spider senses tend to get mangled by the webs of stakeholders, golden rules, and fear, we can instead make some really bad decisions initially. And many times we make these rather important decisions cavalierly, thinking we can simply fix them down the road. Gatekeeping, or good front-end decision-making, takes place in the midst of this juggling of potential outcomes. For example, a young person named Wendy is deciding on a new job. 2 offers come in. The first holds less opportunity for growth, but is close to home. A boyfriend, and parents who don't want her to move too far away. The second offer, the job that feels right, is on the other side of the country, far away from anyone she knows and likely to result in the end of her relationship with the boyfriend. Wendy not only has to weigh all the opinions, wants, and needs of her stakeholders, but she also has to address her fears, what she has been told is right since she was a child, and the long- and short-term implications. The short-term implications are clear. Staying local is easy. She gets to keep her life as usual, and there is little risk. The long-term implications are less known, but it's clear that the faraway job has better prospects, along with the likelihood that she'll lose her boyfriend and anger her parents. And that is frightening. This is where spider senses become critical. Wendy doesn't have a crystal ball. She could talk to people who have experienced similar situations to see how things panned out for them. But ultimately, the only absolute certainty is what she instinctively knows is right for her. And that conviction would likely lead to the best possible gatekeeping situation. It also fosters taking responsibility for her own life. Gatekeeping in this sense not only has implications for her present, but also for her future. By heeding her spider senses, Wendy may have to work through an initial burst of discomfort and anxiety, but she is also likely creating a future that is more congruent with what she inherently knows is right. By ignoring her gatekeeping spider senses, she may find herself with a heap of regret and grow to resent her stakeholders. While in the short term, it seems as though good gatekeeping could lead to estrangement between Wendy and her stakeholders, it is quite likely that sticking around could result in a brewing resentment that, in the long run, would be far more damaging to these close ties and to her career prospects than if she took the faraway job in the first place. It is so easy to blame bad gatekeeping on others if we feel overly swayed by them. But if we honor ourselves, even if there is short-term sacrifice, our ownership of these decisions makes us more steadfast and sets us on a course of taking responsibility and making bolder decisions. The prevailing scientific wisdom says that we do honor our spider senses when we make decisions. But do we ever realize how aware we are of the things that influence us as we make those decisions? Namely, the influences of our stakeholders, the golden rules, and fear. Even when we think we are following our gut instincts, those instincts are still shaped by the larger world. For example, our image of the right person for us romantically is actually a patchwork of a million messages from the world, our parents, and our cultures. That perfect mate will be in part what we think our parents want, what society tells us is attractive, what our childhood storybooks told us prince or princess charming is all about, and the person who protects us from our fears, or plays into them, and who makes us feel safe. And some of those things do matter to us, so even our gut instincts aren't entirely ours. But the question then remains, how much are we choosing on the basis of gut instincts that are shaped by the world? And how much are we choosing to please others, silence the voices around us, and cave in to our fears? Interestingly, when it comes to our gut, the one thing we are able to do is listen to it. And this isn't just about the big-ticket decisions, such as choosing a life partner or a career. This is about a lifetime of gatekeeping at the table. Weight gain, weight loss, and weight management are all about the culmination of decisions over time. Gatekeeping and spider senses. The following anecdote illustrates how your gatekeeping skills, whether ordering at a restaurant or choosing a mate, can benefit from listening to your spider senses. This is the tale of a man who had an important job, a large house, expensive cars, luxurious vacations, a beautiful wife, and two kids in private school. From the outside, his life was great, and in fact, enviable. It seemed he had everything he wanted. But in this guy's head, he had come to the realization that his marriage was over. He had had multiple affairs, including cheating on the women he was having affairs with. He had wanted to stay in the marriage for the sake of the children until they were older. In his mind, he was doing the right thing. He'd made the decision to stick it out until his children moved out, and then he would live the life he'd always wanted to live. He and his wife were no longer growing together, and their relationship had become disconnected. They tried the usual paths to fixing it, marriage counseling, working on communication, but he was done. Still, he stayed. Unfortunately, one of his affairs was with a coworker, a move that breached his company's code of ethics. He was consequently fired, and at the same time, the economy tanked. He lost the big house and all the goodies on which he'd spent.